Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Faculty of Theology entitled Christian Theology and the Universe of Science According to St. Albert the Great. This talk is delivered by Professor Ludger Hohenfelder, Guardini Professor for Philosophy of Religion and Catholic Studies at the Humboldt University of Berlin.
We propose starting our soiree on a lighter note. Speaking of notes, how about some music?
We have Coro del Canto, who will perform four musical pieces. Tonight's musical selection is marked by 16th century compositions. We shall now be assisting to the performance of Jacob Arcadel's rendition of the popular prayer Ave Maria. Arcadel was a Franco-Flemish composer who lived between 1504 and 1568. He served as choir master at the Sistine Chapel in Rome before 1553. Arcadel's style is refined, pure, melodious, and simple, and his music was immensely popular in Italy and France for more than 100 years. This will be followed by Locus Ister by Anton Bruckner, who lived in Austria during the 19th century. He is known primarily for his symphonies, masses, and motets. His symphonies are often considered emblematic of the final stage of Austro-German Romanticism because of their rich harmonic language, complex polyphony, and considerable length. Bruckner's compositions helped to define contemporary musical radicalism owing to their dissonances, unprepared modulations, and roving harmonies.
The choir will be accompanied by Mr. Josef Schwierep, under the direction of Maestro Hermann Farrugia Franz.
Thank you.
Thank you, Maestro Farrugia Franz, Mr. Schwierep, and Coro Belcanto for your excellent performance for this evening. We have just assisted to two sacred works. The first one, O Salutaris, was composed by Sir Edward Elgar. Elgar was a Catholic English romantic composer who was active during the turn of the 20th century. Several of his first major orchestral works, including the Enigma Variations and the Pomp and Circumstance Marches, were greeted with acclaim. He also composed oratorios, chamber music, symphonies, instrumental concertos, and songs. In 1924, he was appointed Master of the King's Music, a post in the royal household of the Sovereign of the United Kingdom, which he held till his death 10 years later. Being Easter time, it was fitting to end our musical selection with a prayer, recited for ages in the special time of the liturgical year, the Regina Caeli. The choir performed the version composed by Gregor Eichinger, an organist to the Fugger family of Augsburg in 1584. He was ordained a presbyter in Regensburg and was very popular for the devout and ingenious mastery of his style. Certainly, this impression is fully borne out by his beautiful compositions, as we have just seen.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, to the matter at hand. This year, the Acta Studentita Theologia is honored to have Professor Ludger Honnefelder as our guest speaker. Professor Ludger Honnefelder was born in Köln in March in 1936. He studied philosophy and Catholic theology at the universities of Innsbruck and Bochum. He obtained his doctorate degree and postdoctoral habilitation in philosophy from the University of Bonn. He held the post of professor of philosophy at the University of Trier, Berlin and Bonn. Moreover, he was the director of the Institute for the Science and Ethics between 1993 and 2007. Since 1995, he was the director of the Albertus Magnus Institute, and for 8 years, from 1999 to 2007, he was the director of the German Reference Center for Ethics in the Life Sciences at the University of Bonn. On April 1, 2005, he was appointed as the Romano Guardini Professor for Philosophy of Religion and Catholic Studies at the Humboldt University of Berlin. Professor Honnefelder is also a member of numerous distinguished international scientific committees and commissions which contribute to the ethical advancement of science in the contemporary academic environment. These include the Nordrhein-Westphalian Academy of Sciences, the Standing Committee Science and Ethics of all European Academies, the Steering Committee for Bioethics, Council of Europe, the European Academy of Sciences and Arts, and the Enquete Commission, Law and Ethics of Modern Medicine, of the German Bundestag. His main scientific interests include metaphysics, ethics, and applied ethics, as well as history of medieval and early modern philosophy. Professor Honnefelder will be delivering a lecture on Christian theology and the universe of sciences according to St. Albert the Great. Surely we're all aware of the fact that much of what we take for granted today is a result of precarious investigations carried out by great thinkers of the past. We are sure that Professor Honnefelder's contribution will help us appreciate more yet another great mind of our Christian heritage. Please welcome Professor Honnefelder.
Your Excellency, Monsignor Annunzio, Your Excellency, Archbishop of Modena, Your Grace, Bishop Emeritus, Your Grace, Vicar General, Distinguished Chancellor and Rector Magnificus of the University of Malta, dear colleagues and students, ladies and gentlemen, let me first express my deep gratitude for being invited by the Theology Students Association and this distinguished theology faculty of the University of Malta and its Dean, Professor Agius, as guest speaker for this academic evening in honor of St. Thomas Aquinas. It's a great honor for me, and I must confess a special pleasure on behalf of my responsibility for the critical edition of the works of Albert the Great, to have the opportunity to speak about what I would like to call the main idea and the key role of St. Thomas's teacher, Albert the Great. The core of what we can call Western civilization or Western culture is the idea of wisdom on the way of science. The idea has several sources, and its historical development is characterized by different and complex steps. But without doubt, in its Western or European shape, the idea is a result of two main sources, both of them deeply connected with the fundamental cultural shift between 800 and 600 before Christ, which has been called by the German philosopher Karl Jaspers an axial time, Achsenzeit, and addressed by Wilhelm Nestle as a revolutionizing step from mythos to logos. The first of these two sources is the Greek discovery of the rational explanation of the world called philosophia, and the second is the Judeo-Christian religious disclosure of God as the unique and universal cause of creation and salvation. The first synthesis of these two movements is significant for a time of at least 1,000 years. The resulting culture, lasting approximately from the first century before Christ to the 12th century, is rich and most impressive, but at the same time restricted. For the first of its sources, called philosophy, is in this process at work only in the structural limited form of the seven liberal arts, not in the adult shape encountered in Aristotle's major works and their Arabic transformations, which were unknown in the Latin West until their translation and reception beginning in approximately 1150 and completed around 1225. It is this second form of encounter of secular philosophy and Christian faith in which the idea of wisdom on the way of science gains its effective form, a form which has more or less determined Western culture until today and which can be called the idea of living human life by recognizing universal truths. My thesis is that it is Albert the Great who plays a key role in this process, insofar he develops the concept of a universe of different sciences as the adequate way of human wisdom and the adequate goal of human flourishing, a universe which is conceived as a synthesis of theology and philosophy. Albert's conception of wisdom as a universe of different sciences was the answer to a challenge he was confronted in the middle of his scholarly career. In his early teaching as lector of his order and in his so-called early works, he followed the model of Christian doctrine which grew out of early scholasticism and the first wave of reception of Aristotle's unknown works. Following Augustine's recommendation in De Trinitate 14 to develop theology as a science for saving and defending the Christian faith, the Latin theologians followed the ideal of scientific rationality as it had been outlined particularly by Boethius. Using central elements of the Aristotelian logic, Boethius connected the Aristotelian ideal of scientific knowledge as a deduction from evident principles with the Platonic ideal of wisdom as knowledge deduced from a first principle. What characterized this new principle of rationality was its universality, its appreciation of concept and argument, its search for necessary reasons, its critical approach, and its program to realize the aim of wisdom by science. The new amor scientiae led not only to a new development of formal logic in the form of dialectics and to a new discovery of nature as nature in the school of Chartres, it also transformed Christian doctrine itself into a scientific project. Studying the scripture was no longer restricted to reading the Bible and explaining it by images and metaphors, but becoming a discussion of sentences, as particularly those of Peter Lombard, in a more or less systematic way. The lectio was followed by the disputatio, which gave rise to the paradigm of the literary genus of questio. The main impulses of this scientific program were not only what was received from Plato and Aristotle, the former in an indirect, the latter in a direct way, but what had been learned from the Islamic and Jewish philosophers. And this was very important because it had been the Arabic scholars of the 9th century, Baghdad, who had understood the various Aristotelian texts as elements of a well-ordered encyclopedia, an encyclopedia which they understood from a more or less Platonic perspective and completed by texts from Hippocrates, Galen, Proclus, Ptolemy, Euclid, and others. It is therefore not astonishing that already Al-Farabi and, as his successor, Avicenna, Ibn Sina, connected this scientific theology by philosophy with the project of Islamic speculative theology, Kalam, discussing how both projects could be reconciled. Because Augustine had in his Confessiones already identified Plato's idea of the supreme good with the logos of the prologue of the Gospel of St. John, the theologians of the Latin West could follow this program and develop Christian theology according this Platonically inspired ideal of science. Christian theology remained what Augustine, following Justin the Martyr, Clement of Alexandria, and the patristic mainstream had already understood it to be, namely the intellectus fidei, when he conceived it as the vera philosophia, the true philosophy. Because Christian theology has at its source the revelation of the first principle, it could answer all the questions the philosopher had put, not only in a fragmentary and uncertain manner, but as a necessary and all-embracing answer. Christian theology could claim to be the realization of Plato's ideal of a comprehensive, unified science. The theological advertation of this ideal did not remain uncontested. Remember, for instance, Tertullian and his damnation of Athens and its wisdom. As can be seen in the teaching of Alexander of Hales and others, the majority of the theologians of the Latin West had no difficulties with accepting the integration of the pagan scientific corpus into the Latin encyclopedia until the first half of the 13th century. Even the books of the natural philosophy, the Libri Naturalis, were able to become part of the academic program in the arts faculty after some unsuccessful prohibitions. And Olbert himself used the Libri Naturalis and the other Aristotelian works without any hesitation in his early works, though in a selective way. But why did he leave this way of scientific work in the 1240s? Why did he set aside his early approach and begin in the age of 50 to spend 10 years of his life commenting the complete oeuvre of Aristotle in 36 works? And why did Thomas Aquinas and the vast majority of theologians follow him in his attempt to trade the Platonic unified science for an Aristotelian-inspired universe of different sciences? What was the reason for taking Aristotle more seriously than before and for changing from Plato to Aristotle? The reasons are complex but significant. I will mention four. As a first reason can be mentioned the restricted character of the Latin concept of science as developed until the 13th century. The leading idea was an encyclopedia of all information, organized according to the subject matter of the liberal arts. The subject matter of natural philosophy was integrated into the quadrivium, but in the end, the rich material of the Libri Naturalis showed that a deductive, unified science of that dialectical type was not able to do justice to the Aristotelian view of nature and to the discovery of nature as practiced in the Charter school. As a second reason can be listed the increasing discovery of the limits of the human intellect. Even the key text of the Posterior Analytics, which presented the ideal of scientific knowledge as episteme apodeictike, as an axiomatic deductive system of truth, made clear that reality cannot be approached from just one point of departure, but instead only under different concepts. Even more than Plato had taken into account, science from a God's eye view is impossible for human intellect. This awareness of finiteness led to a third reason, the question how Christian theology can be understood. In the 12th century, the Summas tried to give systematic structure of the question discussed in theology and adapted Platonic structures to Christian doctrines. But the subject of a science understood in this way is not the individual, but the universal. Not the contingent reality, but the necessary one. Christian faith and revelation, by contrast, have to do with real history, with individual events and contingent facts. Al-Farabi and Avicenna had already discussed the question how Islamic theology, Kalam, could be treated as science and reconciled with the concept of a first philosophy. In the Christian context, the discussion of the difficulties of such a reconciliation had to increase. In particular, the use of the Platonic type of dialectic science as a model of treating theology was bound to reveal the danger of neutralizing the Christian history of salvation, the freedom of God's will, and the contingency of the created world. Revelation is not an access to some God's eye view, but a way to gain the ultimate goal of life through an adequate practice. Augustine himself remembered in his De Civitate that it was the fact that Christ has died once for all, semel Christus mortus est, that had to be considered as the crucial point of history. Against this background, the fourth reason receives its importance. The Latin theologians became more and more aware that the Aristotelian philosophy, particularly in its Arabic interpretation, represented a universal worldview which had natural reason as its only source, without any reference to revelation, using not images and metaphors, but concepts and arguments, and aiming at a scientific explanation, episteme. The discrepancy between the Latin idea of an encyclopedia of contents and the Greek Arabic concept of an encyclopedia of sciences and principles became evident. The Latin theologians became aware not only that the strictly secular design of the Greek Arabic scientific worldview was in competition with the Christian theology of revelation, but also that certain elements were in open contradiction to Christian faith. The strict necessitarianism and determinism, the eternal status of the world, and the assumption that all human beings are intelligent by participating in one separate intellect. And in addition, but independent of this theoretical approach, Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics offered a concept of a happy human life without referring to divine revelation and salvation, based on nothing else than human virtues. Having in mind this background, it is not incidental fact. It is no incidental fact that 3 years after the completion of Robert Grosseteste's translation of the Nicomachean Ethics into Latin, Albert the Great decided to change the traditional curriculum of the Studium Generale at Cologne and to start 2 years later, as he writes in the prologue of his commentary on the Physics, I quote, to make all parts of philosophy intelligible for the Latins, end of quotation. He was aware of the questions his project had to answer. To mention only two. How should the rational view of an eternal and necessary world, as presented by the philosophy, the philosophers, the pagan ones, be reconciled with the world created and governed by God's contingent will? How could the pagan design of human flourishing be connected with the Christian idea of a life based on grace and shaped as an imitation of Christ? As the discussion in the 13th century shows, at least three decisions could be taken. First, to leave the pagan view and its scientific rationality as a perspective of its own, with no relations to the religious view of Christian faith. Second, to repeat the attempt of the Church Fathers and early medieval culture and to integrate the pagan view into a comprehensive Christian view based on revelation and faith and designed in a Platonic manner. But both ways seemed not to be very satisfying. If each of the two instances, Christian faith and natural reason, put forward a different but universal claim, a sort of double truth would lead to a contradiction between natural reason and Christian faith, and therefore destroy one or the other. The first way, as attempted by Kilbertby, Bonaventure, and others, was unable to give a sufficient answer to the above-mentioned challenges. The second way, as chosen by many in the arts faculties, led to the temptation to quit one or the other of the two views and to retain a mere naturalism on the one side, considered to the so-called heterodox averroism in the arts faculty, or to go back to a mere traditional approach. But what to do if natural reason and religious faith cannot be left separate? And if the traditional formula of Christian theology as a comprehending doctrine, a vera philosophia, in Neoplatonic patterns, is no longer convincing? It is the Christian view itself which demands a unity of different perspective, because it is the same God who has both created reason, endowing the human being with intellect and will, and who also reveals his work of grace in the history of salvation. And if the divine source is at work in both ways, faith and reason cannot contradict each other. Becoming aware of the new situation, Albert's interest in studying Aristotle's complete oeuvre was aimed at much more than the acquisition of previously unavailable knowledge. What he wanted to develop was a new understanding of the structure according to which the various sciences differ from each other and form at the same time a unity, and in particular, how Christian theology can be treated as a science fulfilling the criteria of science without leaving behind the basis of faith and revelation. Therefore, in various places, particularly in the introductions to his commentaries on the great Aristotelian works, Albert sketches the outlines of a new theory of science in light of which the relation between Christian theology and philosophy and the sciences could be understood in a new way. This makes his role in the history of philosophy and theology much more than it is usually thought to be. He was not merely a collector, a compiler, a mediator, or a predecessor, particularly of his student Thomas Aquinas. He was not only, as Etienne Gilson stated, the first among the Latins fully to realize the significance of the events. He was also the one who introduced a third way to solve the above-mentioned problems. And it is this third way which was followed by Aquinas and Scotus, and which governed the subsequent development of Western culture. The significance of this solution can be estimated in comparison with the competing medieval cultures. Neither the Islamic nor the Jewish culture, despite their historical pace-setting role, followed this way in the long run, nor did the Christian Orthodox theology of the East. The consequences show the importance of the decision Albert opened for the Latin West. The point of departure of his new solution is the Aristotelian theory of science in the Posterior Analytics, which Al-Farabi and Avicenna had already taken as the guiding instrument. But as can be observed, Albert's understanding of the specific rationality of the different sciences goes far beyond the positions of Avicenna and even Averroes. As a first significant example, Albert's conception of natural philosophy can be mentioned. In determining the subject matter of the Scientia Naturalis, in the prologue to his commentary on the physics, Albert takes as his starting point the idea of distinguishing Philosophia Realis into the three disciplines of metaphysics, mathematics, and physics. But in Albert's eyes, it is not enough to determine the ens mobile, the moving being or the movable being, as the subject matter of physics by an ontological criterion. What characterizes physics as a science is the fact that it fulfills the criteria of the Posterior Analytics. It is a habit of knowledge gained by demonstration from principles. And these principles are not first principles at all, but the first principle of the genus. Natural science had therefore not only to be distinguished from other sciences, but also as such to be divided into different sciences according the different genera in which the ens mobile appears. Each of these disciplines has a unity of its own insofar as each begins from the principles, elements, and courses of the particular genus which forms its subject matter, going on from there to demonstrate the attributes of that subject. In the prologue of his commentary of the Aristotelian Metaphysics, Albert emphasizes the scientific character of the scientia naturalis has to be differentiated, because the subject matter of physics, poetics, and ethics are not eternal and necessary entities, but mutable and contingent ones, these sciences cannot be considered as candidates for a deductive science, in which the attributes of the subject can be derived deductively from the concept of the subject. As Albert states in referring to Aristotle's statements in Nicomachean Ethics 6, science can be understood in a wider sense, which covers natural science and ethics. What characterizes natural science? That it needs experience, experiri, to gain knowledge of universal structures. That natural science cannot be conceived as apodeictic science in the strict sense becomes evident, at least in those disciplines which deal with animals, including the human being. In the first book of his De Partibus Animalium, Aristotle had distinguished the cognitive faculty of theoria and its methodos into two modes of practice, episteme and paideia, science, and erudition. On the basis of this distinction, Albert develops in his commentary on Book 1 of De Partibus Animalium a theory of the scientific rationality of those sciences we can get about something. There are, according to Albert, two cognitive modes to be distinguished. One mode is science as the result of strict demonstration, and the other one, knowledge, which results from a recognition of probabilities. In the life sciences, both modes are at work in a connected way. If the particular nature of animals, we cannot have science, but knowledge of the basis of probabilities. If something is, on the basis of observation, described, defined, and classified in a certain manner, a second mode can take place, which Albert describes as processus assignativus causarum, meaning an explanation of the attributes of the described entity by deriving them from their causes, it is from the subject of the definition gained by previous processus narrativus. Albert emphasizes that the first step is decisive, and this step has as its object the individual, but conceived as a case of a regularity which forms the basis for the definition from which the inferential second step is derived. Lindberg, the historian of sciences, writes, "Judged by 13th century standards, rather by then perceived progress toward modern science, it is Albert the Great who was the innovator. It is he who transformed the debate by abandoning Platonism, the Platonism of Gracetas and the 12th century, and reviving a relatively poor version of Aristotelian doctrine." End of quotation. What Albert presents is not yet natural science in the sense of the early modern period, but he gives the natural sciences a new conceptual home and an intellectual appreciation which opens the way to the later scientific revolutions. Another problem, which in Albert's view can be solved only by recourse to an Aristotelian theory of science, is the problem of metaphysics as first philosophy. If a scientific explanation of something is only achieved when something can be demonstrated by reasons or causes, and if there is an order of causes and reason, then a scientific explanation needs a first philosophy to deal with the first causes and principle. But does this imply that metaphysics has as its subject matter the first causes, particularly the divine being? Against this answer, it can be argued with Aristotle that sense experience is our only access to knowledge, in which case there is no privileged cognitive access to a transcendental, to a transcendent immaterial being. If we did have such an access, a theology such as the Christian one, based on faith and revelation, would be superfluous. But if, on the other hand, all knowledge really is based on sense experience, then doesn't it follow that physics is the first philosophy, with the further consequence that Christian theology as a science of the divine being would be impossible, at least when faith and revelation presuppose a natural concept of what they call God? Confronted with the entire weight of the Aristotelian project of a first philosophy, Albert changes his mind during his work in a most significant way. Familiar with the Neoplatonic tradition, he decides at the beginning of his Aristotle project not to follow this Neoplatonic approach any longer, but to go the way Avicenna has already taken, and to find a solution of the basis of the Aristotelian theory of science. Confronted with the relation between Aristotelian metaphysics and Islamic speculative theology, Avicenna had decided in his Liber de Philosophia Prima, following in the footsteps of Al-Farabi, that the subject matter of metaphysics is not the primum ens, but the primum cognitum, the first known concepts, which are presupposed in every knowledge, including theology. The doctrine of the transcendental concepts, introduced by Philip the Chancellor, as concepts which can be predicated of God, receives now a central place in metaphysics. First philosophy is understood, using the later words of Scotus, a scientia transcendens, a transcendental philosophy. The structure of this solution, which is followed by Aquinas, is significant. The ontological criterion, according to which Boethius introduced metaphysics, namely separateness from matter and motion, is in its central role replaced by the epistemological procedure of transcending our categories to the presupposed most general concepts. First philosophy is understood not as a science of the first, but of the first known, and it is only to that extent a science of the first being. Metaphysics is not episteme theologicae, which begins from the knowledge of the highest good and its derivations, including being, but ontotheology, which begins from the concept of being and conceives the first being as cause of that subject. As dealing with the most abstract concepts, first philosophy has no God's eye view. It is not a scientia propta quid, a deductive science, but only a scientia quia. Therefore, the other sciences as scientia particulares are not superfluous, nor is it necessary to presuppose the first philosophy. Only if you want to explain what is presupposed by the other sciences would you need to deal with metaphysics. Similar relations are significant regarding Christian theology. To reach the goal of human life, knowledge based on faith and revelation is necessary. As science, theology is therefore at the same time possible while using transcendental concepts and necessary while having sources beyond natural reason. The third crucial point in Albert's view is the scientific character of ethics. In his two commentaries on the Aristotelian ethics, he considers ethics not only as an integral part of theology, but as a science of its own, which has the mores, the morals, as its subject matter. Following on Aristotle's concept of science, in a wider sense, as described in Nicomachean Ethics 6, there is ethics as ethica docens, which deal with the dispositions which lead to virtuous practice, and there is ethics as ethica utens, which in its perfect form can be considered as the eudaimonia which human practice is aiming at. Ethica docens is moralis philosophia and has to be distinguished from theology. The former deals with perfect practice as gained by human virtues, and the latter with perfect practice as gained by virtues infused by God's grace. What Wieland has called the Entheologisierung der Ethik, the de-theologization of ethics, the differentiation between ethics and theology, obviously has its roots in the 12th century. But it is again Albert who understood ethics as a science of its own with a scientific methodology of its own. Ethics is not part of theology, but a discipline with special relation to theology. And again, Albert tries to connect the Aristotelian concept with the question of its foundation on a higher level when he exposes how ethics is caused by the first cause without being immediately derived from that cause. In reaction to Nicomachean Ethics 10, he even concedes there is a form of intellectual happiness which our intellect, as an intellectus adeptus, can gain. What it really means, in Albert's view, to get wisdom on the way of science becomes clear when we refer to his understanding of theology and the crucial point of the relation of theology to philosophy. From the beginning of his oeuvre, Albert wants to clarify the task of Christian theology in relation to the concepts of science and wisdom, and his goal is to avoid two extremes: a straightforward understanding of theology as a wisdom which includes all other sciences, and an understanding of it as something which is not a science at all. What he wants to show more and more is that theology is a science, but a science of its own, and that only the special way of being a science can establish the connection between faith and reason, on the one hand, and the particular object of theology on the other. And the more weight he gives to philosophy, the more he becomes aware that he cannot follow the way of the preceding magistri in Paris and elsewhere, but has to open a new way. A way which in principle is that of Aquinas and many others. Christian theology is, as he wants to show, a science of its own because it differs in its subject matter, in its formal character, and in its goal, all the while fulfilling the criteria of science as demanded by Aristotle in his Posterior Analytics. Theology, he emphasizes, is neither a philosophical science, nor can it be reduced to one of these sciences. But, I quote, insofar as science is an acceptance of truth by certain and unchangeable reasons, it is possible that Christian theology, which deals with what is believed by faith, is a real science, scientia vera. Following the tradition of Augustine and Lombard's sentences, Christian theology has as its subject matter things and signs, res et signa. Having this in mind, Albert emphasizes that this cannot mean that Christian theology embraces the totality of knowledge so that we would not need other sciences. But what is the subject matter of Christian theology and its specific approach? Significantly, Albert gives his answer in his Summa Theologiae by comparing Christian theology with philosophy, particularly with metaphysics. Philosophy is, in his eyes, what can be known by natural reason, and because the human intellect is restricted in its capacity, it cannot know all things in the way of a science propter quid, but, and that is in a God's eye view, but only in a scientia quia, in which things can be grasped only under a certain concept on the basis of sense experience. And it is the first science in this order, metaphysics, which is in comparison with all other sciences the most universal, because it has as its subject matter the most common concept being as being. The horizon of this transcendental concept enables metaphysics to demonstrate the existence of a first being, insofar as metaphysics reaches a knowledge of the divine being, it can be called theologia, but its knowledge of the divine being is restricted in metaphysics because the human intellect is not able to grasp this being as its subject, it is in its essence, but only as its course. Christian theology does not have a universality of this type. It has its own approach, which Albert characterizes in the same context as the highest mode, altissimus modus. It is by the principles of faith which enable us to call Christian theology wisdom in the most principal sense, sapientia principalissime. In its depths, faith exceeds all other sciences and asks for its own principle by which it will be demonstrated. The theological truth reveals itself by a divine light. In so far, the truth of the revealed scripture is accepted in the conscience of the believer in the particular mode of piety. Beginning from the accepted truth of the articles of faith as superintelligibles, Christian theology has God as its subject from which his attributes can be concluded, but God, insofar he is, as Albert writes, Alpha et Omega, Principium et Finis, which means as principle of creation and salvation. This understanding of Christian theology implies that it is a science which is universal in a particular sense and which goes beyond the distinction between theoretical and practical sciences. Theology is not universal in the same sense as first philosophy, which is universal as dealing with the most common concept. Insofar as theology deals with all things under one single aspect, that of fruibilitas, it is of fulfilling the highest desire, it is at the same time particular and universal. This does not mean that we do not need the particular sciences which deal with things under their different aspects. Because Christian theology deals with God as fruibile, it is in Albert's view at the same time theoretical and practical, or, as he explains, effective, affectiva. This does not mean that theology is a mystical knowledge or something irrational. Because Christian theology has God as subject, insofar he reveals himself not only as the first being, but also as the object of fruition, theology exceeds the distinction between theoretical practical and explains something which is at the same time grasped by the intellect and accepted by the will, something which Albert describes in his commentary on the sentences as verum beatificans intellectum. This does not mean that theology includes ethics, which as moral philosophy has perfect practice by acquired virtues as its subject matter, because theology deals with perfect practice by infused virtues. If we want to characterize the relation between first philosophy and Christian theology as it is conceived by Albert in a short formula, we could say that both sciences are related to each other, not in a hierarchical model, not in a hierarchical mode, but in a dialectical process. Both have a universal truth claim, but on different levels. First, philosophy opens the universal horizon of the human intellect, but cannot give the sufficient answer to the intellectual and volitional desire. Theology gives this answer in an effective but particular way, but presupposes for the scientific explanation of its truth the horizon of first philosophy. And in this way, the traditional concept of Christian theology as vera philosophia is replaced by an open synergy of philosophy and theology as two different but related sciences. And it is this concept which Aquinas develops in detail. To come to a short conclusion, if you want to find the formula which characterizes Albert Oeuvre, is it unity by distinction? And this on the basis of a structural pattern of sciences. When he recognizes zones of conflict, he looks for a solution on this level and develops this structure in detail. The basis of his solution is not only the distinction between faith and natural reason, nature and grace, experience and revelation, second and first causes, and so on. Dominating is the distinction between different epistemic levels and correlated scientific approaches. Models of hierarchy are not the governing instrument. Where a hierarchical order is necessary, it is based on epistemically differentiated approaches. The unifying method, still at work in his own early texts, is replaced by a plurality of different but not unordered scientific methods. Philosophy and science in general are autonomous in their orders, but restricted in their various scopes. This approach is connected with a new understanding of the human intellect, which could be called at the same time a naturalization and a transcendentalization. On the one hand, the human intellect is not understood as a separate entity, but as a potency of the unique human soul, deeply rooted in the vegetative and sensitive potencies. On the other hand, it is understood as a potency which, while beginning from sense experience, is able to transcend this level and become an intellectus adeptus, which even has the faculty of mystical cognition. This way, Albert can keep the identity between theos and logos, but as an identity which can be recognized only in a differentiated approach that maintains tensions rather than eliminating them. Philosophy becomes autonomous, but restricted in its reach and dependent on future research. Theology saves its universal truth claim, but from a restricted point of view. It becomes free from the tasks connected with its self-understanding as true philosophy, but acquires the possibility of developing a better understanding of the contingent history of salvation and of the credibile and fruibile as the last aim of human existence. Because Albert transforms the heritage of the traditional concept of wisdom into a new understanding of wisdom on the way of science, he opens a way of justifying Christian faith under the condition of an emancipated human reason that understands the world in a scientific fashion. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Bonnefelde, for your enlightened lecture. We are so honored to have you among us for this evening celebration in honor of St. Thomas Aquinas. I met Professor Bonnefelde about 15 years ago at the Council of Europe. We were both delegates of our countries in our discussions at the Oviedo Convention, the Convention on Bioethics in the New Sciences and Biotechnology. Since then, we met many times at the Council of Europe and other conferences. We strengthened our academic and also friendly relationships. It wasn't that easy for Professor Bonnefelde to find time to visit us. In fact, I have been attempting to invite him for the last 3 years. Finally, we succeeded to bring him over to Malta. Thank you very much for accepting. I know that you are very busy at the international institutions and also in your country. I found this evening's lecture quite revealing and interesting because in our philosophical formation, we have always focused on the contribution of Thomas Aquinas, especially in taking the challenge to dialogue with his own culture. Rather than taking the position of his contemporaries, especially vis-à-vis the Aristotelian philosophy, he discovered the third way, which I always thought that it was Thomas Aquinas' contribution. In fact, Professor Hornefelder's lecture was revealing because it was his master, St. Albert the Great, who proposed and develop this third way, not the way of abandoning the pagan philosophers, not the approach of the church fathers in tackling the issues from a Platonic, Neoplatonic way, but in proposing this new way of understanding these sciences, especially in Aristotelian philosophy, which was abandoned and unknown for many centuries, and at the same time to acknowledge the autonomous field of both theology and these universal sciences. What I find interesting, I don't want to dwell on these points, but I think St. Albert the Great offers us a model how to approach our theological studies, because today we are facing new challenges. Thomas Aquinas and his master, St. Albert the Great, succeeded to dialogue with their own culture and establish an approach which was quite influential for many centuries in Western civilization. I think today we have our own challenges. I think this challenge has been taken for us, this is just to mention a few examples by Théa de Chardin in the 50s, by trying to establish dialogue between theology and sciences. This is the approach which is being taken also by contemporary philosophers of culture, like Charles Taylor and McIntyre, who who are suggesting a new ways of virtues and new practices in today's culture. And I think today Europe, European civilization, is facing definitely new challenges, especially in the new sciences and biotechnologies, which theology can contribute a lot, not fleeing, not hiding, not closing discussions with these new powers of our own culture, but to enter into dialogue. And I think these are the institutions we have in Europe, where we are discussing these, especially in the Council of Europe and also in the European Union, the European Group of Ethics to which I belong, which is a challenge to try to find how values, even Christian values, can shape the future of our European civilization. I think that you have raised many issues and many questions. I would like to begin with a question myself, Professor Honefelder.
What contribution, what dialogue can we establish with today's sciences? St. Albert the Great was courageous enough to change his presuppositions and to rethink the model in a paradigm shift to make theology more relevant to the universal truths and universal sciences.
Thank you very much. I think you can distinguish between a scientific explanation and the question on meaning or sense. And if you take the sciences can give answers to questions of scientific explanations, but it's not their scope to answer questions regarding what is it all about and what specific meaning the human being will have. But I think it was important to use the, for instance, the Aristotelian natural philosophy for anthropology. And if you read Aquinas or Albert the Great, you can always find that they attempt to develop anthropology on the basis of this natural philosophy in Aristotelian patterns. And if you, when John Paul II visited for the first time Germany, he gave a lecture in the Cologne Cathedral to a large number of scientists. And all scientists were very astonished about the solution which the Pope presented. And at the end of his speech he said, what I presented to you as a solution for the relation between faith and reason, theology and sciences, is Albert's solution. And if you read the last lecture of our present Pope, written for the lecture in the Sapienza University, you can find again that he uses this model of unity in difference, according to Aquinas, but which has its origin in Albert's position. And I think this approach will be a fruitful and usable a platform for such a dialogue between and in life sciences and in the bioethics debate. I think it's unavoidable to use as a guideline the Aristotelian concept of a living being. And as far as I can see, it is usable in patterns of modern biology too. And then you can derive certain criteria what establishes a living being, or what in Latin is called an animal.
Thank you, Professor Honefelder, once again. We have now come to the end of our academic evening and would like to thank you all for having honored us with your presence.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Faculty of Theology entitled Christian Theology and the Universe of Science, according to St. Albert the Great. This talk was delivered by Professor Ludger Honfelder, Guardini Professor for Philosophy of Religion and Catholic Studies at the Humboldt University of Berlin.